Everyone, my name is Clara Beaver, and I'm going to be talking today about treating metastatic HER2 negative breast cancer, the oncology nurse's approach to improving patient quality of life. I just want to give a big thank you to Gilead Science, as they did an educational grant to allow us to provide this education to you guys. Creative Educational Concepts is the group that is doing this program for you. They do have accreditation with multiple different companies to allow you to get CMEs and CEs for this program. This slide is just a slide to show you if you have ILNA points for ONCC, what it has been categorized as for your ILNA points. And I can bring this back up at the end if you want me to. This activity may include discussions of products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the FDA. I've been informed of my responsibility to disclose to you if there's any off-label or investigation uses that we are talking about during the program. There really is not during this one. This is me. My name is Clara Beaver. I am a manager of nursing education and a clinical nurse specialist at Karmanis Cancer Institute in Detroit, Michigan. And I'm very happy to be speaking to you guys today from Michigan. So I hope it's warmer there than it is here. This is a disclosure page. This is for all of our faculty and for the people that help put the program together. All right, now let's talk about our learning objectives. The first objective is that we're going to summarize the impact of adverse events associated with antibody-drug conjugate use on the health-related quality of life of patients with HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. We're also going to differentiate patients with HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer who are at risk for receiving higher grade AEs when receiving ADCs. And we're going to select optimal approaches to the management of AEs associated with ADC use with patients with HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. So let's start off a little bit talking about the unmet needs of HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer patients. As we're aware, breast cancer affects women, and the 5-year overall survival rates continue to be significantly lower in Black women, 80%, versus white women, 91%. In the tables on here, you can see the incidence for all different ethnic groups. And then you can also see the mortality, which the median age of death due to breast cancer is 68 years for all women, 70 years for white women, and 63 years for Black women. So we still have some work to go on making sure that we have equitable care for our patients. As we know, endocrine therapies are effective when we have hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative disease, and the endocrine therapies have a smaller effect on quality of life than what chemotherapies do. When we give patients chemotherapies for endocrine therapy refractory hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative and triple negative breast cancer, we have seen that it is really associated with a diminished quality of life for our patients, which is why side effect management is so important in this patient population. The slide over here just shows that 80 to 85% of patients that are endocrine therapy refractory, about 65 to 75% of them are hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive is about 15 to 20%, and triple negative is less than or equal to about 15%. So really today we're going to talk about antibody drug conjugates that are used for metastatic breast cancer. This here is a nice slide. It just really shows the makeup of the antibody drug conjugates. I'm really bad at saying the names. So for the sacituzumab, we're just going to call SG. For the daptotamab deruxtecan, see, look really bad. We're going to call Dato-DXd, and then the trastuzumab deruxtecan, we're going to call T-DXd. But what's important on these slides, I think, is that you just look at what the makeup of what an antibody drug conjugate is. And I really like to look at this because it helps me understand a little bit more of what's happening with the actual drug. So all the antibody drug conjugates have this Y-like shape, and these receptors down here go to what the receptor on the cell is. So for SG and Dato-DXd, the receptor is the TROP2, And for the trastuzumab, it is HER2, much like normal Herceptin. With the antibody drug conjugates, you have these little cleavable linkage that carry this, what we call a payload. So this right here is SN38 for SG. And then for the other two is the DXD. And this is a topo one inhibitor. And so what these do is once they get into the cell, they release and then they continue to kill the cell, which is my next slide, where you can see how the antibody drug conjugates really work. So antibody engagement really leads to payload-independent anti-tumor activity, and it happens via a couple mechanisms. First, the Fc-mediated stimulation of the immune cell. So right here you can see the ADC attaches to the receptor, and then it makes this little flag for the immune system to see that this is not a normal cell, and it needs to help us fight that cell. And then it also disrupts the receptors from being functional. So these little receptor cells are also looking for things out in the bloodstream to help the cell grow. And so if we're blocking that, we're really disrupting the downstream signaling of the cell, so it's not able to produce. Once these antibody drug conjugates are taken into the cells, they start to release the little payload, so the SN68 or the deruxtecan, the DXD, into the cell. And then that starts to have liposomes and endosomes that really lead to the death of the cell. So you can see all these little yellow spots here. These are the payload that's been released, and it's really starting to break down that microtubule and really stop the cell from growing. The nice thing about the ADCs is that they do have this bystander effect where it can start to look at other cells that are very similar and start to kill those cells as well. So that's why the ADCs work really well. This is for breast cancer, but we have seen them work in other therapies as well. So let's talk a little about triple negative breast cancer. The next few things that I'm going to talk about are studies that we've used to see why these antibody drug conjugates really work with metastatic breast cancer. So the first study we're going to look at is the ASCENT study. This is where SG was used in second line or later with metastatic triple negative breast cancer. So the patients that were in this study had received two or more chemotherapies, one of which could have been used in a neoadjuvant setting. Providing progression occurred within the 12-month period. Patients with brain metastasis were also allowed in the study, but they had to be stable. The patients were randomized 1-to-1. They either received SG or treatment of the physician's choice, and they continued on treatment until progression or unacceptable toxicity. The primary endpoints were progression-free survival, but we were also looking for progression-free survival, for the intent to treat. Overall survival, overall response rate, duration of response, safety, and quality of life. So, what was found in this study is that there was statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival in the patients that received SG versus the treatment of physician choice. For progression-free survival, it was 4.8 months versus 1.7 months. And you can see on our curve here that I can't talk all of a sudden. There was a separation very early on and continued throughout. And for median overall survival, the SG was 11.8 months versus 6.9 months. And again, you can see that separation between the two. And that's what we really look for in these curves, is that separation in between to see how many patients actually benefited versus not. What they found in the ASCENT trial is that neutropenia, diarrhea, and nausea were the most common side effects with SG over the treatment of physician choice. They did find that the median time of onset for neutropenia was about 16 days. And the neutropenia occurred earlier in patients with a reduced UGT1A1 activity. I'm going to talk about that in a few slides, so I'll let you understand what that is a little bit more. The primary prophylaxis that we found was G-CSF, which is really recommended in the first cycle of treatment in anyone with an increased risk of febrile neutropenia. So it could be older patients with previous neutropenia, poor performance status, organ dysfunction, or multi-comorbidities. And then also, we're going to talk about this a few other times as well. We're going to withhold if they have an ANC below 1500 on day one of any cycle and below 1000 on day eight of any cycle. What they found in the study is that the quality of life in all the functional domains was higher for SG versus treatment of physician choice. So we really want to see this above zero. And when you don't see it above zero, you can still see the SG performed higher than it did for the treatment of choice. Here's another slide that just looks at the quality of life symptom domain. And again, SG did better than treatment of choice, except for nausea and vomiting and diarrhea were the ones that the patients complained more about with SG versus the treatment of physician choice. All right, now we're going to talk about hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative breast cancers. The first study we're going to talk about is the TROPiC-02 study. And this is, again, SG in pretreated patients that had hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, locally recurrent, inoperable, or metastatic breast cancer. So these patients, to be eligible for the study, had to have at least one endocrine therapy, taxane, and CDK4/6 inhibitor in any setting, at least two but no more than four lines of chemotherapy for metastatic disease, an IHC0, IHC1+, IHC2+, ISH negative, and measurable disease. The patients were randomized 1:1, again, SG, and then treatment of physician choice. Again, our endpoints were progression-free survival, and secondary endpoints were overall survival, overall response rate, duration of response, patient-reported outcomes, and safety. Again, the TROPiC-02 study showed that there was statistically significance for progression-free survival and overall survival versus chemotherapy. Not as high a curves as we saw in the other ones, but our median overall survival was 5.5 months in SG versus 4 months in the treatment of physician choice. And overall survival was 14.5 months versus 11.2. So again, a little bit better. The same side effects were shown, neutropenia, diarrhea, and nausea, as what we saw in the first trial, not surprising. And again, median time of onset was about 16 days. They did still, again, recommend the primary prophylaxis of G-CSF, and then withholding for an ANC of 1500 for day one of any cycle and below 1,000 on day eight of any cycle. A box warning has been placed for SG for breast cancer patients. Again, neutropenia, severe, possibly life-threatening, and then diarrhea, which may be severe or lead to dehydration. The AEs of concern are hypersensitivity and infusion-related reactions. Again, we need to watch our patients for those. Nausea and vomiting, and then increased risk of adverse reactions in patients with that reduced UGT1A1 activity and embryo fetal harm. About 63% of the patients had neutropenia, 34% anemia, 45% had fatigue, and 59% of the patients had diarrhea. 57 had nausea, and then you can see the other things on the slide. So let's talk a little bit about what UGT1A1 status is and why the safety outcomes were important for this. So UGT1A1 is a variant effect of enzymatic function causing reduced metabolic capacity. Over 50% of individuals, every day individuals, may harbor this UGT1A1 polymorphism, which is dependent on genetic ancestry. There are commercial tests available for this UGT1A1 polymorphism, so it is important that we're using this on our patients to help us understand their side effects a little bit better. What you can see in this table down here is looking at the ASCENT trial and the TROPiCS-02 trial. They found that patients that were normal metabolizers of UGT1A1, intermediate, and then poor metabolizers all had a little bit different response with their side effects. And you can see for pretty much all of them, the poor metabolizers did worse. So they had more neutropenia, they had more diarrhea, they had more anemia, and more febrile neutropenia. So again, it's really important for us to understand whether our patients have this polymorphism, and it will help us with their side effect management. So when you think about UGT1A1 polymorphisms, you may think like, well, should I look at it more in one ethnic group than another? And really what they have found is that African Americans and Afro-Caribbeans and Latinos are the highest poor metabolizers. But if you look at this slide, pretty much every ethnicity has some degree of either intermediate or poor metabolism in their lines. So it is important to look at all of our patients to see where they are and if they have these polymorphisms. The TROPiCS-02 study also looked at overall response rate and time to deterioration. And what they found was that the SG patients did better than the treatment of choice patients. So for the global health status, overall quality of life, about 4.3 months, patients reported that they were doing well versus 3 months. Fatigue, for about 2.2 months, patients did really well with the SG versus 1.4 in the treatment of choice. And pain, about 3.8 months versus 3.5 months. So again, we saw a better quality of life with our patients receiving the SG versus the treatment of physician choice. So the indication for SG for breast cancers are triple-negative breast cancer, unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic triple-negative breast cancer patients who have received two or more prior systematic therapies, and at least one of them for metastatic disease. For hormone-receptive positive, HER2-negative breast cancers, the patient has to be unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancers who have received endocrine-based therapy and at least two additional systemic therapies in the metastatic setting. So these are the indications for the SG. Now, the TROPION-Breast01 looked at the Dato-DXd versus chemotherapy in hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. The key eligibility criteria were unresectable or metastatic hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative breast cancer, prior endocrine therapy, and 1 to 2 lines of prior chemotherapy in inoperable metastatic setting. Again, this was randomized 1 to 1, the Dato-DX versus investigator chemotherapy of choice. The primary endpoints were progression-free survival and overall survival, and secondary endpoints are overall relative rate and progression-free survival and safety. So again, the progression-free survival was looked at, and it did show statistically significant that Dato-DX was greater than the investigator chemotherapy of choice. So 6.9 months versus 4.5 months. Now, we don't have overall survival yet for these patients, so they're looking at the time for subsequent therapy on these patients. And patients that received Dato-DX did not have to go on to another line of therapy for 8.2 months versus the investigator of choice, which was 5 months. So again, those are very important things to look at because this just shows that the survival is better for those patients, although we don't know that data yet, but they're not going on to another therapy. So there was no progression for their patients. The side effect profile for Dato-DX, dry eyes was the number one thing that patients complained of, and then stomatitis was the other one versus the investigator choice. So oral mucositis and stomatitis led to discontinuation in one patient in the Dato-DX group, and then ocular events were mostly dry eyes, and there was one patient that did discontinue treatment in the Dato-DX group. The other thing that was found was that there was drug-related interstitial lung disease. Although the rate was pretty low, and it was mainly a grade 1 or 2, you can see down here that the Dato-DX group had 9 patients that had all grades versus 0 in the investigator of choice. So it is important that we're looking at our patients for that interstitial lung disease. So the AEs of concern, again, that interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis, really making sure our patients understand that. The ocular adverse reactions, again, talking to them about the dry eyes, using eye drops, and reporting that. Stomatitis, what it is, what we can do for it, whether it's a salt and soda solution, and again, making sure that they understand what they're looking for, and then embryo fetal toxicity. Again, hematologic leukopenia occurred in 41%, lymphopenia in 36%, neutropenia about 30%, fatigue in 44%. Again, we see that dry eyes at about 27%, and the stomatitis was pretty high in 59% of the patients, with nausea being 56%. So Dato-DX received an indication for hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative breast cancer for unresectable or metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer who have received prior endocrine-based therapy and chemotherapy for unresectable or metastatic disease. So I want to talk a little bit about HER2 and the status with HER2. So years ago when I Many, many years ago, when I started in the infusion center, and we looked at HER status, we did our staining and we looked, it was either positive or negative. We didn't have an in between. And that's really when HER2 started, is when we had these positive HER2 positive cells, breast cells. So if you look over here, you can see the top is a breast cancer cell and it's stained. And you can see all this brown staining here. And that's a very positive HER2 positive breast cancer cell. That cell, if I saw that, I would definitely treat with Herceptin or something else for her that was HER2 positive. Now, down here is this HER2 low. And you can see that there's very little, but you can still see some brown staining. Now, in the old days, this would have been made negative, and the patients would not receive Herceptin or any HER2-based therapy because it didn't show that there was a lot of activity. But what we know now is that even with this little bit of activity, there is still possibility that the cells are going to uptake the HER2 receptor and be able to kill those cells. And then you can see this bottom one is the HER2 negative. You don't see any of the brown staining. You don't even see the cell clumps the same way. And so these patients obviously have no receptors that would accept the HER2 drug. And so these patients would not be eligible for that type of drug. Well, you can see over here in hormone receptor positive cells, about 30% of the patients had the zero. 46% have that plus one. So again, 46% of the patients with our old coding would have never received therapy. And about 17% had plus two. In our triple negative breast cancer patients, you can see about 26% of the patients have some activity with HER2. So even though they're being counted as a triple negative, there's still a possibility we can treat them with something in a HER2 with a HER2, and it would be acceptable. The cells would accept that and start to kill the treatment. So about 34 to 63% of breast cancer patients considered HER2 negative under the current guidelines express those low levels of HER2. So again, we're treating about 34 to 63% more patients than we would have in the past. So I think that's a great thing that we found, and that drugs are actually working for these patients. The next trial we're going to talk about is the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. And this was the first randomized phase three trial of the trastuzumab DXd for HER2 low metastatic breast cancer. So the patients, again, were HER2 low. So they are ICH1 plus or ICH2 plus and ISH negative, unresectable and/or metastatic, treated with one or two lines of chemotherapy and metastatic disease. And the hormone receptor positive disease was considered endocrine refractory. So they had to receive some endocrine therapy, but it was not working. Trial was a little different. It was randomized 2-to-1. So they received more of the patients received the trastuzumab DXd versus treatment of physician choice. Again, our primary endpoints are looking at the progression-free survival. Key secondary endpoints are progression-free survival and overall survival. And then the secondary endpoints are, again, that progression-free survival, overall response rate, duration of response, safety, patient-recorded outcomes, and overall survival for our patients. So this is actually broken down into at 24 months and 36 months. So again, there was statistically significant progression-free survival and overall survival in the patients that received trastuzumab DXd of 8.8 months when they looked at the study at 24 months, and then 8.8 months at 36 months, and this was versus 4.2 months. Now, what the difference was in overall survival at 24 months, it was 23.4 months for the trastuzumab DXd versus treatment of choice at 16.8. At 36 months, it did drop just a little bit to 22.9 months for the trastuzumab DXd versus 16.8 months for the treatment of choice for the physicians. So again, you can see that these curves, especially with the progression-free survival, did differentiate very quickly and stayed very far apart. And the same here, you can see that the patients did do a little bit better when they were receiving the trastuzumab DXd. The AEs that were found were neutropenia and anemia were higher in the trastuzumab DXd, nausea, and fatigue. They did find that there was left ventricular dysfunction occurred in 17 of the patients on trial. Two had cardiac failure, one had a grade one, and one had a grade two. Now, if any of you have given Herceptin or trastuzumab, you know that that's not uncommon. We do know that there's cardiac issues when we are giving trastuzumab. I am old enough to know when we did our original trials with Herceptin. We had four arms, and one of our arms was shut down very quickly because we were giving trastuzumab at the same time as Adriamycin, and we actually had a lot of cardiac failure with our patients, and that arm was immediately shut down. That is also why you do not give the Herceptin until after the Adriamycin and Cytoxan are completed because of that cardiac dysfunction. So again, when we're giving this trastuzumab DXd or antibody drug conjugate, we need to make sure that we are watching our cardiac function of our patients. Again, there was some interstitial lung disease with these patients as well. 45 patients of the trastuzumab DXd arm did have that interstitial lung disease. So again, the interstitial lung disease looks like that DXd payload is what is causing that interstitial lung disease. So there are boxed warnings for trastuzumab DXd, and that is that interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis that can be severe or possibly life-threatening and embryo-fetal harm. The AEs of concern, again, neutropenia and febrile neutropenia, and that left ventricular dysfunction. So neutropenia occurred in about 70% of the patients that received this, anemia in about 64%. Fatigue was about 49%, which is pretty significant. Nausea in 76%, vomiting in 49%, and then again, constipation, diarrhea, abdominal pain, and stomatitis in patients as well. So the DESTINY trial really looked at quality of life. So what they did is the total population prior to starting treatment did a baseline quality of life study. And the scores were pretty similar, 36.3 for the trastuzumab DXd arm versus 37.8 for the treatment of choice. Then what they did is they looked for a median change in the baseline for the patients. And so they really looked at that to see how long it took for that to change. And for the T-DXd arm, it was about 27 cycles is when they really saw that that mean change of like 10 points happened for the patients. And in the treatment of physician choice arm, it was about 13 cycles. There really wasn't a lot of patients beyond these data points to be really informative of what happened further than that. The median time of duration of the quality of life for patients was reported about 7.6 months for the trastuzumab DXd arm versus 5.1 months for the treatment of choice. And then There was a subset of patients who received the trastuzumab DXd that provides significantly higher global quality of life scores and functioning and lower pain scores than the patients that received capecitabine. This slide really just shows that the patients reported scores. The numbers on the left favor really that trastuzumab DXd, and the ones on the left favor the treatment of physician choice. You can see really the only ones that patients were upset about versus the TXD were that nausea and vomiting. So again, most of the scores were in favor of the trastuzumab DXd. So trastuzumab DXd indication for breast cancer for HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. So patients that have unresectable or metastatic HER2 positive breast cancer who receive prior anti-HER2 based regimen, either in metastatic setting or neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, and have developed disease recurrence during or within 6 months of completing therapy. And then the HER2 low, HER2 ultra low metastatic breast cancer patients. So they have unresectable or metastatic hormone receptor positive HER2 low, so ICH1 plus or ICH2 plus ISH negative, or HER2 ultra low, which are ICH0 with membrane staining. And the membrane staining has to be determined by the FDA approved test that have progressed on one or more endocrine therapies in the metastatic setting. The HER2 low breast cancer, again determined by the FDA approved test, who have received a prior chemotherapy in metastatic setting or developed disease recurrence during or within 6 months of completing adjuvant chemotherapy. So now let's talk a little bit about managing the AEs in our antibody drug conjugate patients. So as we all know, the benefit of early side effect management really does affect our patients and how they receive their care and for them to stay on therapy. The goal of cancer care is really to recover our patients to that pre-cancer quality of life, emotional and social functioning. We want this to be a blip in their road or a road bump that they're going over, as I frequently tell my patients. We want to get them back to the other side that and be able to live the life that they had before. So again, it's only possible if we mitigate the side effects of anti-cancer treatment. So again, early screening, suspicion, and prompt identification of the AEs are crucial for improving our patient outcomes. So again, education through our patients, education to our providers, the people that are looking at them. So whether it's the infusion nurses, the clinic nurses, even the nursing assistants that are doing those intakes for our patients, to have really that prompt and timely management for our AEs. The use of specialists, either dermatologists, ophthalmologists, pulmonologists, are important to help us manage those organ-specific AEs, as our oncologists know how to take care of cancer. They know how to deal with neutropenias, anemia, some of our basic side effects. When we start to see more dermatologic or pulmonary or ophthalmologic issues, they're not as skilled in those. And so that's when we really need to call in our specialists and say, like, hey, this is what's going on. But we need to make sure that they understand that it's related to the chemotherapy, immunotherapy, whatever they're taking at the time. We need to assess for potential or synergistic or overlapping toxicities when we're combining our ADCs with other anti-cancer treatments, whether it's chemotherapy, immunotherapy, radiation therapy, anything else that we're giving our patient. We really need to make sure that we're looking at what side effects could be because we're giving multi-dose therapies. And then proactive management and interdisciplinary collaboration to address these challenges. That really helps with the safety and efficacy of the ADCs in our breast cancer patients, and ultimately is going to improve the clinical outcomes for our patients. What they did find is with SG that dose reductions and treatment interruptions in the ASCENT trial did not appear to reduce efficacy of the drug. And I think that's important to know because I remember when I worked at the bedside, patients that refused to tell me about side effects because they didn't want to go off treatment because they thought that they were not going to get effects from that. And so they would frequently hide peripheral neuropathies, or they would hide their fatigue, they would hide other things that were happening with them. So it's important to teach our patients that they need to let us know about these side effects so that we can help them be able to function and be able to stay on treatment and be able to be cured. But to be able to do that, we need to make sure that they are talking to us about what's happening to them. And really, it's important we encourage our patients to discuss symptoms and side effect management challenges to the healthcare team. I started back in the late 90s, and patients were scared about the nausea and vomiting that happened in the 80s, the 80s through the early 90s, when we really didn't have a lot of things for nausea and vomiting. And now, as you all know, we have a very wide arsenal of things that we can use for nausea and vomiting. And patients frequently just think it's part of treatment and something to live with. And we just really need to let them know that it's not. There's other things that we can do to help them get through that, so they're not in misery for, 5 days or 7 days after treatment, and they just start to feel better when they come back to us. So again, making sure that they have open communication with us and be able to talk to us about what's happening to them. Management of neutropenia, we talked about this during the slides, but I think it's just important to bring up again because a lot of times the infusion nurses may be the ones that are seeing this. So if a patient receiving SG has a grade 3 or 4 neutropenia, and that's really when the ANC is less than 1,000 or febrile neutropenia, again, we already talked about it. We're going to withhold the SG until our ANC is greater than 1,500 for day one and greater than 1,000 for our day eight dose. We're going to give G-CSF as clinically indicated, and we'll reduce one dose level for each occurrence of febrile neutropenia or prolonged grade 3 or 4 neutropenia, and then we're going to discontinue after 2 dose reductions. At the time of scheduled treatment, if the patient has a grade 3 or 4, which delays dosing beyond 3 weeks of the recovery to grade less than or equal to one, then we're going to discontinue treatment and we're going to give them G-CSF until we can get them back to where they need to be. For trastuzumab DXd, the dose reductions for neutropenia, again, for grade 3, we're going to hold until the dose is resolved until grade 2 or less, and then we're going to maintain our dose. If it's a grade 4, we're going to hold dosing until they're resolved to less than or equal to a grade 2, and then resume with a reduced dose and then discontinue after the second dose reduction. The Dato-DX, there was no dose modifications listed in the package insert. Again, it's just important to monitor our patients. Now, diarrhea. I don't know when you guys ate lunch. I know it's around lunchtime for you, but of course, we have to talk about diarrhea. And when we grade diarrhea, if you ever treated a patient with a RhinoTCan, you know all about diarrhea and all about grading diarrhea. But we are seeing more diarrhea with a lot more of these newer agents. So again, making sure our patients understand what the grading is and when they need to call us to tell us what's going on. So a grade 1 is an increase of less than or equal to 4 stools per day above what they normally have. And there may be a mild increase in the ostomy output. A grade 2 is a grade a increase of 4 to 6 stools per day above their baseline, a moderate increase in their ostomy output. But really, the grade 2 poses limitations to instrumental daily activities of daily living. So they can't get that far away from a bathroom. They can't get out to get groceries. They can't leave the house. They can't go to work. Those instrumental daily activities of daily living because they have to stay close to a bathroom. Grade 3 is the increase of greater than 7 stools per day above baseline, severely increase in the ostomy output, and it poses limitations to self-care activities of daily living. They can't get out of bed. They can't get out of the bathroom because they're having so many stools. They're starting to get raw. They can't get up and eat. They can't get enough fluid in because the minute they take anything in, it comes right back out. Usually, hospitalization is indicated if they have a grade 3. Hopefully, we can catch them in a grade 2 and get them better. Grade 4 is life-threatening consequences, dehydration, fluid status, severe electrolyte imbalances. This is really urgent and immediate intervention is needed. Hopefully, our patients don't get to that before they call us. So when we're looking at GI toxicities, the first sign of loose stools, we really need to teach our patients to start those antidiarrheal agents and increase their intake of oral fluids. Again, if they're having diarrhea, they're losing electrolytes, right? So water, Gatorade, Pedialyte, things that are going to increase their electrolyte balance as well. For most medications, if they have a grade one or two, we're not going to do most dose modification. We may hold a dose if they're at a higher grade two, but we're not going to really see dose modifications. If they have grade three or four, we will suspend the dose until the toxicity resolves to less than a grade one, and then the dose will be reduced on those patients. So when we talk about the management of diarrhea, again, if you've ever given a RenoTCan, you know these acute and early cholinergic syndrome. It happens during or shortly after infusion. The patient complains of abdominal cramping is usually the number one sign of it. There can be sweating, diarrhea, and excessive salivation that also occurs in the infusion center when they're receiving treatment. We can give atropine 0.4 milligrams IV every 15 minutes times two doses if needed, and then 0.2 milligrams for a total of 1 milligram while they're there. And then the most important thing is if they have this, we just need to prophylactically use atropine when they come in because the patients, it's uncomfortable for them, and we don't want them to have that again. So if we use the atropine prophylactically in our future cycles, a lot of times we can get them out of that syndrome, and the patients will actually feel better receiving treatment. If they have delayed diarrhea, which usually happens for more of our patients, rule out that infection first. You don't want a C. diff going and telling them to block everything up because that's never a good thing. But 9 times out of 10, it's not infection. So we really treat our patients to start on that loperamide, 4 milligrams orally after the first loose stool, followed by 2 milligrams PO after each subsequent loose stool for a total of 16 milligrams in the day. And then we tell them to keep taking that until 12 hours after their last loose stool. Now, high dose, 4 milligrams PO times one, and maybe followed by 2 milligrams PO every 2 hours. That's more of the irinotecan dosing that you'll see. But again, all of these are over the counter, so our patients can go to the pharmacy and pick those up. We can also try octreotide if the patient has a lot of diarrhea, or oral atropine if needed. But again, it's really important to teach our patients to replace fluids and electrolyte as needed. Again, I can't say enough about making sure that they're drinking water, even Gatorade. There's new Gatorade Light that has more electrolytes in it. Sometimes Pedialyte works for our patients as well, but we really need to make sure that we're replacing those electrolytes. Again, we need to counsel our patients on the risks of severe diarrhea, teach them about those signs and symptoms of the cholinergic syndromes. I mean, I always teach my patients if they feel any different than when I start their infusion, they need to let me know, and then I can treat them as needed. Again, advising our patients to promptly start those antidiarrheals at the symptom onset. I mean, I can say I'm bad about that too. Like I had diarrhea for like 4 days for one time, and then I was like, oh wait, I should be taking Lamotrigine because I don't have to be having this. But again, patients may think it's just part of getting treatment. So we need to make sure that we teach them to do that. Encouraging a bland diet until the GI symptoms improve. I cannot tell you the number of times patients would eat Wendy's chili when they were getting treatment. Not good while they're receiving treatment, especially if they're going to have diarrhea. They really need to go to a more bland diet. So even if the chili or something spicy sounds good to them, encouraging that bland diet to really give their gut some rest while they're having the diarrhea and we're getting rid of that. Again, replacing fluids and electrolyte orally if we can, IV if indicated, and then monitor and assess for any signs of dehydration. Again, teaching our patient about that excessive thirst, having their skin not really bounce back like it did before, that feeling of fatigue that comes when you have dehydration, those types of things so that they know to let us know. And then encouraging our patients to call if they have black or bloody stools. They don't have the ability to drink oral fluids. They have nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea that's not responding to supportive medication. Again, remember our patients, one, don't want to bother us, and two, often think that this is the cost of getting treatment because that's what they've always heard people complain about. So really changing that mindset that they need to let us know what's going on because there may be ways that we can help them. If a patient has interstitial lung disease from the trastuzumab DXd, you can restart the medication if the patient has a grade one. But it all depends on how long it takes for the patient to have their interstitial lung disease resolve. If it resolves in less than 28 days, we're going to maintain our normal dose. If it's greater than 28 days, we're probably going to reduce our dose by one level. And then there was one study by Swan et al. That recommended that if interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis occurs beyond day 22 and has not resolved within 48 days up from the last infusion, we really should discontinue the TDX. And again, we may want to, for grade one, consider corticosteroids use treatment while the patient is recovering from this. If it's a grade two to four, we're immediately going to start them on corticosteroids and then permanently discontinue the trastuzumab DXd. Again, it's really with interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis, as we're learning more and more about this, with especially we're seeing this more with some of our immunotherapies, it's really important to work with pulmonology to help us understand this a little bit better, to help us treat the patients, to really look at those x-rays to differentiate from other things. I know originally when COVID first came out, there was some looking at those x-rays really closely to see if it was COVID versus interstitial lung disease. What was going on? Was it pulmonitis related to what drugs they were receiving? So again, that's where a pulmonologist can really come in and help us understand how to treat our patients appropriately for what's happening with them. When we talk about that, we really talk about this team-based approach of management with our patients with cancer. So again, multidisciplinary teams are really important when we're talking about treating our patients with cancer. If we're using multidisciplinary teams, it really increases the treatment personalization for our patient, improves the outcomes, preserves the quality of life, and increases the overall patient satisfaction. But for that to work, all of us have to talk to each other. So the nurses need to talk with the physicians need to talk with the specialists. We need to be able to read and understand what's going on with our patients, and we need to communicate that to the patient and their caregivers. So each person on the care team should really encourage the use of comprehensive molecular biomarker testing to, one, make sure that we're giving the patient the best treatment that we can, ensuring that we're using guidelines to coordinate with care, so evidence-based practice, and being available for our patients and our caregivers to answer questions at a level that they understand. There are a lot of our patients that after the medical oncologist walks out, they look at you like a deer in the headlights because they have no idea what half of the words were that they just said. So having someone that can break that down for them and really have them understand what the physician is talking about, what the treatment entails, and really making sure that they understand what the next steps are for them. And then after your talk today, we're hoping that you can use some SMART goals to put this information into action. So SMART goals are specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-limited goals. So again, documentation. Document the impact of AEs on the quality of life of patients who are receiving the ADCs for HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. And how do we do this? We really obtain improve patient histories. We ask them what's going on. We increase the use of AE assessment tools and documenting all of our findings in the medical records of our patients. Managing the AEs in patients who are receiving these ADCs according to updated guidelines and expert consensus, making sure we stay up to date on that. And then as documented by increased use of mitigation strategies in our charts for our patients. And then, as I said, communication is key. Patients should be encouraged to communicate quickly when they experience AEs to the team so that the team can help them manage those AEs. There are additional resources available on the CE Concepts website. There are also additional activities. CE Concepts also has this great patient resource guide for patients that are receiving ADCs for treating metastatic HER2 negative breast cancer. It's actually a really nice slide. And then this is how you claim credit. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.